Good day. Today is Tuesday, 24th February 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me again remind you to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel if, once you've watched this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, yesterday in my programme, I discussed the fact that there had been, according to reports, a high-level meeting in the White House between the President, Donald Trump, and his advisers. And the advisers included his top military chief, General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Ratcliffe, and to the President's frustration and perhaps anger, it turned out that the military and the intelligence officials at this meeting informed the president that they could not guarantee the success of a military operation against Iran. Now, since I made my program yesterday, a cascade of further reports have appeared across the American media about this meeting. And there's been now reports in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Axios, all sorts of other places. Someone is briefing very hard, is going out of their way to give the account an account of the meeting that took place on Sunday. And all of these reports essentially confirm the original report, the initial report in the New York Times, which I discussed yesterday, except that they tend to go much further. I am not saying that General Kane and Director Ratcliffe, according to these reports, positively advised against an operation against Iran, but they made their own doubts about this operation very clear. They told the president that Iran would be very far from any kind of cakewalk. There was no certainty that the government there would fall as a result of any attack, that there was a real possibility that the United States would face retaliatory action by Iran's missile and other forces. There were possibilities of American bases across the Middle East being attacked. There was also possibilities that American soldiers would be killed and would be returning to the United States in body bags. And there's been a fascinating article today in the Financial Times, which seems to bring all of this reporting together in one place. It says that it discusses this meeting that took place in the White House. It makes the same points that have been made by myself and others, that there is no driving obvious reason why the United States should attack Iran at this particular point in time. Iran currently is not attacking or threatening to attack any country unless it is first attacked itself. By the way, this has, contrary to many claims, been the pattern with Iran since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. Many of the steps that Iran has taken, which many people refer to as aggressive, when one examines them, are nearly always reactive. It tends to be overlooked, for example, that Iran fought a long war in the 1980s when it was attacked by Saddam Hussein's Iraq, a war in which Iraq received significant assistance from the superpowers of that era, the United States and the Soviet Union, and, well, other instances, other occasions when there's been duels between the Iranian military and other militaries have also tended to happen after there's been an attack on Iran itself. This has been especially true of the various exchanges of missiles and airstrikes that have taken place between Iran and Israel since the spring of 2024. That sequence began with an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus. And, well, altogether, and without in any way suggesting, by the way, that the Iranians are angels or that they are always and invariably innocent parties, mostly, it seems to me, in the vast majority of occasions, they don't attack unless they are themselves attacked. Certainly, they are not attacking anybody now, and they're not threatening anybody now, except in the event of retaliation, if they are themselves attacked. To repeat again a point I've made in several recent programs, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has publicly said that Russia in December brokered a deal between Iran and Israel that neither country would attack the other unless it was itself first attacked. Neither Iran nor Israel have denied that that informal agreement was made. So if one assumes that this agreement exists, as I'm sure it does, then there is no proximate threat of an attack against Israel at the current time by Iran, contrary to what all sorts of people are saying. Nor is there any evidence that Iran is about to acquire nuclear weapons. And of course, President Trump himself has recently been insisting, was insisting after the June 12-day war last year, that Iran's entire enrichment program had been obliterated. So when I heard yesterday President Trump's chief negotiator, Steve Witkoff, say that Iran is only a week away from enriching uranium to the level needed to create a nuclear weapon, well, not only do I not believe that claim, I've seen no evidence of this, but I would like some explanation for the contradiction. It seems to me that the president's earlier claims and those made by the administration today are in clear conflict with each other. Anyway, so there was no need to start this whole operation now, which is a point that this Financial Times article says. And there is no very clearly defined, straightforwardly explained objective. Various US officials, including the president himself, have sometimes said that it's all about Iran's nuclear program, its uranium enrichment program. At other times, the topic of ballistic missiles has been introduced. At other times, still, it's all about protecting protesters in Iran itself from actions by the Iranian authorities. And at still other times, it's about Iran abandoning its regional allies, invariably referred to as its proxies. And at still other times, it's about achieving regime change in Iran. And as the Financial Times says, when there are so many different objectives being provided when the rationale for the military operation is so vaguely explained, quite apart from anything else, quite apart from the fact that that calls into question the good faith of any explanation given. What that must make is a military planner's nightmare. What exactly is the outcome, the objective that the military are being asked to achieve here? Anyway, the Financial Times said all of this. It also said that the military at this meeting advised President Trump that whatever the objective was, there was no guarantee that they could achieve it. And in addition, we now have information about the state of the military force that has been gathered around Iran. Firstly, the point has been made by many people, made by myself in the past, made by others, Alistair Crook, for example, many times, Douglas MacGregor, others as well, that regime change, if that is the objective, tends to happen, in fact, has almost invariably happened when there has been a ground invasion and there are nowhere near enough troops in the Middle East at the present time to conduct a ground invasion of Iran. And Iran being a country of 90 million people with an enormous territory, very mountainous, with large armed forces, probably better, more motivated and more disciplined than Saddam Hussein's armed forces were, just to say. This is a nightmarish prospect, and occupying such an enormous country is an even more nightmarish prospect if there is serious resistance to an invasion, as there almost certainly will be. So regime change on its face is already looking extremely problematic and very, very difficult. But there are also problems with any operation, aerial missile operation, that the United States might be thinking of conducting against Iran at all. And again, we come up with the problem of the shortages of missiles, shortages of air defense missile interceptors, Patriot missile interceptors, THAAD missile interceptors. There's apparently been some uptick in production of THAAD missiles. But no one seriously imagines that it has come anywhere close to meeting the needs in the event that there was a sustained Iranian drone and missile offensive against targets across the Middle East and in Israel itself. So critical shortages with air defense missiles, critical shortages with offensive missiles as well. Here I presume what is referred to as Tomahawk missiles. It seems that the attempt to crush the Houthis last year used up a lot of Tomahawk missiles. I have always assumed that dented rather than depleted the stockpile, but perhaps the stockpile is not as big as we were led to believe. Maybe some of the Tomahawks are not in a particularly good state of repair. There's always the problem, obviously, that if the Tomahawks are launched from the warships, which basically they have to be, then there's only so many Tomahawks that any warship can carry. And going to port to restock with Tomahawks is going to take a long time and will cause interruptions to the campaign. That's one issue. Besides, I suspect that there are people in the Pentagon who've also been asked to retain a strong force posture against China in the Asia-Pacific region. They look at the size of Iran. They look at the enormous number of targets in Iran. They look at whatever air defense system Iran has. And we are getting reports that with aid from the Chinese and the Russians, the air defense system in Iran has been materially improved since the 12-day war in June. And they're saying to themselves that however many Tomahawk missiles the United States launches against this enormous country, it will never be enough to achieve any decisive outcome, but it will be more than enough to drain remaining arsenals of Tomahawk missiles, which the United States critically needs in a standoff with China. There being apparently as many issues in terms of serial production of Tomahawk missiles as there are in terms of serial production of Patriot missile interceptors. Anyway, I've seen a report, I think it was in the Financial Times article, it might have been somewhere else, that apparently Israeli intelligence has taken a look at the situation with the US forces that have been concentrated in the Arabian Sea and in the Gulf region. And their assessment is that they are sufficient for no more than an intense 5-day missile and air campaign against Iran. If the missile and air campaign were less intense, that might be extended to perhaps a week or even 10 days. But if one conducts a less intense campaign at the beginning, then that is going to reduce the effectiveness overall, and it will give more time and opportunity for the Iranians to adjust to any attack that takes place. And, well, if General Kane and the military and intelligence people told Trump this, well, it's understandable why they might also have said that given the lack of missiles, given the heavy maintenance of the aircraft, and I read somewhere that F-35 fighter jets would only have a limited amount of time over Iranian airspace anyway because of relatively short ranges of these aircraft, and this is putting aside any risks they might face from Iranian air defences. Well, all of this might have led the military and intelligence people to tell the president a 5 to 10 day attack is not going to be sufficient to bring about the collapse of the government of Iran. If that is the plan and the intention, which, by the way, on the president's part and on the part of the Israeli government and on the part of the president's political allies and donors who are agitating for this war, people like Senator Lindsey Graham and the Fox television commentator Mark Levin, well, that is clearly what their objective is. So they're telling the president this might not be possible. It might not be something that the US military can achieve given the resources that are in play. Now, this, by the way, brings me back to the topic of Russian and Chinese aid for Iran. And I made the point in an earlier program, after after I discussed an article by Jennifer Kavanagh in Responsible Statecraft, in which she also spoke, in fact, the latest reporting vindicates that article, that there are critical shortages of air defense missiles in the United States, that there has been this massive drain of air defense missiles because of the US need to supply air defense missiles to Ukraine. Since Joe Biden took the decision in the spring of 2023 to start supplying Ukraine with Patriot missile interceptors, the United States has critically depleted its arsenals of those missiles. And with Zelensky, whom we'll come to later in this program, continuing to make endless demands for more and more missiles, insisting that Ukraine needs unlimited supplies of air defense missiles, and with Ukraine's advocates in Washington also pressing all the time for Zelensky's demands for missiles, missiles of every variety, to be met, and with the Germans busy buying whatever new production Patriot missile interceptors roll off the production lines so that they can be transferred to Zelensky and to Ukraine, where basically these missile interceptors achieve little or nothing, just saying. Anyway, with all of these demands for Patriot missile interceptors, because of the war in Ukraine, the Russians have already provided indirectly critical assistance to Iran by conducting the war in Ukraine, because it has had a major effect on US military capabilities. It has drained the stockpile of air defense missile interceptors. That already became obvious during the 12-day war back in June, which was, of course, a further drain on air defense interceptors over and above that already created by the war in Ukraine. But since the 12-day war in June, because the war in Ukraine still continues, that drain of air defense interceptors and other weapon systems continues, and it is weakening American force posture. Now, having said that, I don't think that Russian and Chinese help to Iran has been solely in this indirect form. I do believe that the Chinese are keeping the Iranians fully informed about the movement of US warships and US troops around Iran. I believe the Russians, with perhaps rather fewer resources, are doing the same thing. Fewer resources, but nonetheless sufficient resources, are doing the same thing. And of course, we continue to get all sorts of reports and rumours about air defence missiles, other intelligence assistance, help from China and Russia to Iran, enabling Iran to deal with its domestic challenges. So Iran, a more difficult target in some respects than it was in June. This time the Iranians are not going to be caught by surprise by a further attack, and the Iranians getting help in advance this time from their friends, and with their offensive ballistic missile stockpile apparently partially or even entirely replaced since June, and with their missiles allegedly made more effective through Russian help with targeting and upgrading of their accuracy capabilities. So one could see how all of the problems arise and why General Kane and Director Radcliffe gave the advice they did. It is absolutely clear that the President himself was very upset and very angry by the advice. And he was made angrier still by the fact that this advice that he received over the course of this meeting was then published all over the media. And he followed up by one of his other extraordinary messages on Truth Social. He said that all of these reports are fake news, that General Kane remains as bullish as ever, that it is untrue that General Kane gave the advice that he is universally reported to have given, that just as the President himself, this is according to Trump, just as the President himself would prefer a diplomatic solution to a military solution, General Kane would want the same. But if the President makes the decision to go for a military solution, General Kane supposedly is an enthusiastic member of the team. The attack on Iran will be easy. It will be another cakewalk. Well, the President didn't use that word, but that seemed to be the implication of what the President said. And General Kane is fully up for this. Now, I don't believe the President, I have to say this. If General Kane's advice really was being misreported, I would expect briefings from the Pentagon and from the Joint Chiefs of Staff directly after these articles started to appear saying as much. So I don't believe the President. I think that the reports are true. Every single article that has appeared across the media after the President's Truth Social post appeared, continued to write as if the earlier articles setting out General Kane's advice were true. And, well, that now leaves the President in a very difficult position. He talks about a limited strike, but as I discussed in my programme yesterday, why would the Iranians accept that? Why would they confine themselves to a limited counter-strike? There's reports that are now appearing that the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, who is, I believe, 86, but very soon 87, has apparently told his senior officials that in the event of a war, he expects that he will be a target and that he anticipates that he will himself be killed. His objective is not to preserve his own life, but to preserve and safeguard the Islamic Republic, which was placed in his trust when he was elected supreme leader decades ago. And supposedly, steps have already been taken to replace him when, as he anticipates, he himself will be killed. So there it is. Now, there's supposed to be another meeting, maybe on Thursday, in Geneva, between Araghchi and Witkoff. There are reports that President Trump is now telling his officials that the final decision as to whether or not there will be an attack on Iran will depend on the report that Witkoff and Kushner send back to Washington after this meeting in Geneva takes place. the Iranians are still taking the tough line they have consistently taken. They will not give up completely on uranium enrichment. They will not negotiate over their ballistic missile program. Discussions about their commitments to their allies and about their internal situation are off the table. It is limits on their enrichment program that they are prepared to discuss, something they have always been prepared to discuss. After all, they agreed to the JCPOA, and as they never cease to remind people, it was the Americans, not them, that walked out of the JCPOA at a time when it is universally acknowledged that Iran was in compliance with its terms. So that is the only proposal from the Iranians that is on the table. If the president accepts what will be, as some have called it, JCPOA light, he will antagonize and infuriate people like Lindsey Graham and Mark Levin. There will be complaints from people like that he's caved to the Iranians, that he's betrayed Israel, that he's betrayed the United States, that he's left a terrorist entity in Iran still in place. If he goes for a limited strike, he has no guarantee that it will achieve any outcome that he wishes, and it could easily evolve into a long war, which is what the Iranians are threatening. Alternatively, if he decides to override the advice of people like General Kane and go for a long war from the outset, there is a real risk that Iran might turn out to have greater endurance than the United States itself does, in which case things could also go wrong. It seems to me that the President, Donald Trump, is close to finding himself in a Zugzwang situation, the chess situation, where whatever move he makes, he's going to find himself in a worse position than he was before. There is, of course, always the possibility, which must not be completely disregarded, that an attack on Iran, even a limited attack on Iran, will indeed result in the collapse of the Iranian government. And that's something I am not in a position myself to say will never happen. But it seems that Radcliffe and Kane don't expect that, in which case, whatever the president does, it's inevitably going to upset someone on his own side and potentially leave him in a worse position. Of course, he could have done the wise thing. He could have told people like Lindsey Graham and Mark Levin that there was no cause to start a conflict with Iran at this time, to have kept those warships in American bases or patrolling the Asia Pacific, in which case the president would not be in the hole that he is now in. But of course, that's not what he chose to do. Now, I'm going to finish this point here by making a few brief points which relate not to Iran and the United States, but to Russia and the United States. One of the most extraordinary facts about the entire Ukrainian conflict is Russia's ability to outproduce the United States in key weapon systems. The Russians have no shortage of missiles with which they strike Iran. They continue to strike Iran with missiles continuously. It now happens every night. So there is no shortages of missiles here from the Russians, even though the Russian missile offensive on Ukraine has been enormous. By contrast, we see that the United States is now suffering problems with shortages of offensive missiles. Russia has no shortage of air defense missile interceptors either. Ukraine has been conducting a massive drone offensive against Russia since the summer. Firstly, attacks on refineries, now attempts to attack industrial facilities like the one at Vodkinsk. But the Russian air defense system remains very active and continues to bring down the drones and the missiles, the Flamingo missiles. And of course, it's very active on the front lines as well. The Russians seem to have no problem maintaining the pace of production of air defense missiles. The Americans, by contrast, are not able in the same way to keep up with production needs of air defense missiles. The Russians, of course, produce tanks, armored vehicles. The United States no longer makes tanks. It refurbishes old ones. There was that article a few months ago in the Financial Times, which spoke about how the United States no longer makes new Abrams tanks. It refurbishes old ones. And the time period to refurbish a single Abrams tank is around 2 years. A lot of people, again, this is an issue that I've discussed in many places, talk about the length of the war in Ukraine, even though, as I pointed out, in terms of historical time, it has not so far been a long war at all. Not by comparison with other superpower conflicts and great power conflicts that have happened in the past. The point is that Russia can keep going year after year. It can increase the size of its armed forces. It can produce more and more weapons. It can keep up supplies of missiles. It has the endurance and the industrial and economic capabilities to sustain a long war. The United States cannot. It can only conduct a short war. Even if this report from Israel that the United States can only conduct an air operation, air and missile operation against Iran on the basis of the currently deployable forces of 5 days, or between 5 and 10 days, is an overstatement. Perhaps a bit of misdirection, who's to say? Even if, as I said, it overstates the position, I doubt that it overstates it by very much. Russia's ability to sustain a long war is a strength. It is not a weakness. America's inability to conduct long wars and its need to conduct wars and end them quickly is a weakness, not a strength. As I've discussed in many places, long wars are real wars and produce real, substantive, long-term outcomes. Short wars achieve only ephemeral results, which eventually fade away, often leaving more problems and greater problems in their wake. It's a simple point. It amazes me that people don't get it. But anyway, I've discussed it many times in the past. This is the point when I go to repeat it again. Now let's turn to that other conflict, and let's turn to the situation in Ukraine. And of course, as we are being tiresomely reminded by all sorts of people. Today happens to be the fourth anniversary of the start of the special military operation. All sorts of extraordinary claims about this anniversary continue to be made in the West. And in fact, at least in Britain, there is undoubtedly an active briefing war underway. Somebody is clearly trying, well, somebody from the government is clearly trying to shape the narrative about the war and the way in which it is being conducted by the Russians and about the way in which the war is going. So we continue to see and hear Western European officials repeat the mantra that the Russians expected that the war in Ukraine would be over within 2 days. Now, no Russian official at any point ever said anything like that. Putin did not. No other Russian official did. Putin set out at the beginning of the special military operation what Russia's objectives were, and they did not in any place refer to the conquest and annexation of Ukraine. They spoke about achieving neutral status, preventing Ukraine from joining NATO, denuclearization, demilitarization, denazification, those sort of things, not the outright conquest of Ukraine. In fact, on the very first day of the special military operation, during a meeting with the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev, Putin expressly denied that it was his plan to occupy the whole of Ukraine. And on the very second day of the special military operation, when the Ukrainians said that they were prepared to negotiate and to discuss Ukraine's neutral status and to give up their quest to join NATO, Putin actually ordered a temporary ceasefire. I remember this very, very well. And then about a couple of days later, negotiations between Russia and Ukraine began in Belarus and then continued in Turkey and then led up to the Istanbul Agreement of April 2022, which, of course, as we all know, the Ukrainians walked away from. So that's the first point to say. Again, it's strange that people dwell on this about some Russian plan to conquer Ukraine in 2 or 3 days, which no Russian official ever announced. And going back to that long piece about the origins of the war set out by Sean Walker in The Guardian, the big takeaway from it, as I've discussed already from my point of view, is that the Americans and the British had no inside information from the Russians at all. They have no information about any plan on the Russian from the Russians to occupy the whole of Ukraine within two, three days or a week or whatever. This claim that there was such a plan or such an intention by the Russian side is purely a product of Western spin. So that is one thing. But the other thing that is currently happening, and again, it is a very obvious case of Western spin, is that we are now back at that narrative of stalemate on the battlefronts, that the Russians are making minimal gains, that they're suffering unbelievably high losses, that Russia's economy is under extraordinary strain, that the Russians have not achieved their full objectives in the war. By the way, that is completely true. The Russians themselves say so. Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, confirmed that today, just saying that the Russians have not yet achieved all the objectives of the special military operation. But in every other respect, the resurrection of this stalemate narrative, very quickly, when you actually look at things close up, which is, of course, what people scarcely ever do, it never really stands up. It is entirely based upon unchallenged claims, firstly about Russian losses, which no one can know with any accuracy. We do have information from Russian losses, about Russian losses provided by Mediazona. I have gone along with those in the past, and I'm going to continue to do so, but they don't come anywhere close to giving us the kind of numbers that we're hearing currently from the West, just saying, or from the Ukrainians. Of course, the two are the same. So all of these fantastic claims about Russian losses, about the Russians losing more men than they are recruiting, and that this supposedly is happening for the first time over the last month or so, there isn't a scintilla of evidence from the battlefronts to support that claim, by the way, just saying. There have been moments when the fighting spikes and when Russian losses grow, and perhaps there have been the odd month where losses have indeed surpassed replacements. But then the spikes pass, the fighting subsides, and the losses on the part of the Russians are quickly made up again. The same cannot be said for Ukraine, where, on the contrary, we get a clear evidence of decline, and something which is here confirmed by Ukrainian sources themselves, and which has been an ongoing process that became critical after the defeat of Ukraine's summer 2023 offensive. And as I've discussed many times, claims about Russian territorial gains are also distorted, obviously distorted, because places that the Russians have captured, often important places, are either not referred to, or when they are referred to, there's always claims that they are still under Ukrainian control. So this has been said about Pokrovsk, Kupiansk, Mirnograd, Guliapolye, Stepnogorsk, all of these various places at various times, that the Ukrainians still control them, even though the evidence obviously shows that they have passed, that they passed under Russian control some time ago. So the Russians have also been talking about the special military operation and the four-year anniversary. And as I discussed in my programme yesterday, Putin spoke about the war being an existential matter for Russia. To be more precise, he said it was essential in order to defend Russia's security and independence. Not difficult to work out independence from whom, by the way. But perhaps even more interesting are the series of comments that have been made by Dmitry Medvedev, the vice chairman of Russia's Security Council, the de facto head of the Military Industrial Commission, the man in charge of Russia's military industrial complex. And I recently pointed out in a program that heading the military industrial complex brings Medvedev very close to the Russian military. It means that he meets senior people from the Russian military, almost certainly Gerasimov himself, but other military officials regularly. Probably he has some contacts with the Russian military, with people from the general staff every day. And some of the very forthright statements that he makes probably reflect sentiments from within the military. And I pointed out also in a recent program that a former very high-ranking Russian general, Colonel General Kartapolov, who is now a member of the Russian Parliament, of the Duma, and who heads the Duma's Defense Committee, and who was until recently a member of Russia's General Staff, of the General Staff, and who is known to be a close friend and associate of Gerasimov himself. He also has been speaking recently about the optimal objective, the optimal outcome for Ukraine itself would being Ukraine's annexation by Russia. The objective, which was never discussed or floated by any Russian official 4 years ago at the start of the special military operation in 2022, is being discussed now. That's the first thing. Medvedev made extraordinary set of statements which point clearly in that direction also. I said in my program yesterday, I'd only incomplete information about this meeting. I said that at this meeting, which incidentally Medvedev attended in a military uniform, in a camouflage jacket. He is, like Putin, a complete civilian, but he's now wearing military uniform when he meets military officers, which suggests to me, incidentally, that he's been given some kind of reserve rank within the Russian military hierarchy. That's purely a guess. Anyway, Medvedev didn't just tell the Russian soldiers that Russia seeks victory, but not at any price, and that Russian soldiers should take care of their lives when they're fighting. But he said other things, which I find even more interesting. First of all, he ridiculed Kaya Kallas. Well, of course, everybody ridicules Kaya Kallas nowadays. I'm not going to dwell on that. But he also said things about Zelensky. He said that the best outcome, the very, very best outcome of the war for Zelensky would be for him to escape from Kiev and from Ukraine with his ill-gotten gains and flee to the West. He said, Medvedev basically said, that it's because Zelensky fears for his position and does not want any one of these, this sort of outcome. That is one of the reasons why he wants to keep the war going. But it was the other two outcomes that Medvedev spoke about in relation to Zelensky that struck me. Medvedev said that if that didn't happen, if Zelensky did not flee to the West, then he faced one of two possibilities. Possibility one is that he would end up like Mussolini, executed by his own people. And in the case of Mussolini, by the way, having the further indignity of his dead body hanged upside down together with some of his associates in a public square and subjected to indignities by the people. It's one of the gruesome episodes at the very end of the Second World War. Well, that's already a pretty stark outcome for Zelensky, if something like that were ever to happen. But Medvedev also floated another possibility, and this was the one that interested me even more. And that possibility was that Zelensky could end up like the German leader, like Hitler himself, in the bunker, and that that would be the moment of his end. Now, of course, the point about that is that the reason for ending life in the bunker was that the Red Army reached Berlin. Is this not perhaps a hint from Medvedev that the Russian army is indeed heading towards Kiev? Just a sec. Anyway, it was an extraordinary series of very stark statements. Now, the Russians have also made further statements today, and they are extremely disturbing, not perhaps because they actually describe the actual situation, but because of what they again say about Russian objectives. The Russian intelligence agency, the SVR, is saying that there are discussions underway between Britain and France about providing nuclear weapons to Ukraine. That this is a plot that is being hatched, either to provide Ukraine with some kind of dirty bomb, or possibly with a smaller nuclear device, like the kind of nuclear device that the French produce. Now, I have to say straight away that I cannot believe this. There are some very unbalanced and fanatical people in London and Paris, but I cannot believe that they would go to these extreme lengths. I think the Americans certainly would find out about it, and of course the Russians claim that they already have, and they undoubtedly would if anything like this were indeed being attempted. And I think that it would be blocked, because doing something of this kind would not only finally and conclusively destroy the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but it would absolutely bring us into World War III territory if something like this really were to happen. And I don't think that the British and French governments are quite there yet. I accept there are some very unbalanced and even fanatical people around in London and Paris, but I don't believe that any of the major decision makers would actually do something of this kind. I think this story has an entirely different purpose. I think the purpose of this story is to develop and plant the idea that an independent Ukraine, led by any variation of the current political structures, the political structures that have existed in Ukraine since the Maidan 2014 seizure of power or coup, are inherently dangerous, that they would constantly be thinking about acquiring nuclear weapons, and that there would be a risk that some of the NATO states, in this case Britain and France, might actually facilitate that. So that what the SVR is in effect doing is it's planting the idea where any form of independent Ukraine, governed by any part of the existing Ukrainian political elite, the post-Maidan elite, is such a danger to Russia that it cannot be tolerated. And if we go back to what Medvedev has just been saying and what Kartapolov said a few days ago, it seems to me that a head of steam is building up in Moscow, which says, look, we are now coming close to the point where victory is not just in our sights, but perhaps a proximate objective. We cannot negotiate an outcome that allows any kind of political entity to survive in Kiev or Lvov or any other place. Any such entity would be a constant and enormous threat to Russia itself. We've seen many times that agreements that we enter into, both with the Ukrainians and with their Western sponsors, are not worth the paper that they are written on. What we must do is move forward either to full annexation or to the establishment in Kiev of a government that is so friendly to us and so closely aligned to us that ultimately it is a government that we control. That, it seems to me, is far more likely to be the explanation and the purpose of this story. Now, I discussed in various programs, extending back several months now, how it seems to me that there is an internal debate going on in Moscow about how the war in Ukraine should end and about the benefits of negotiations with the Ukrainians and with the Americans. And some people in Moscow, it seems to me, have probably always been skeptical about the wisdom of these negotiations at all. And it could very well be that this report from the SVR is a public expression of this debate, or consistent with the very hard line that Medinsky took at the talks in Geneva on Wednesday. It could be that this SVR report also reflects this hardening of Russia's line, which has been taking place over the last few weeks. What I will say is that it seems to me that the main decision maker, Vladimir Putin, continues to be very reticent in discussing Ukraine. But I noticed that today, Putin's spokesman, Peskov, said that there's been no agreement yet on holding a follow-up meeting between the Americans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians following the meeting in Geneva. At the Geneva meeting, Medinsky gave the impression that a follow-up meeting would take place within a few days. But so far, it seems that no such meeting has been agreed. Perhaps we will learn information about a follow-up meeting in a few days' time, or perhaps even today, for all I know. But for the moment, at least, or at least as of the time of making of this programme, it seems that this is still up in the air. And the fact that Peskov said this may further suggest that the Russians are unconvinced that a meeting at this time would be beneficial. Though it must also be said that given that Witkoff and Kushner are going to be drawn into discussions very soon with Araxi in Geneva over the far more pressing Iran crisis, it could be that it's the Americans who are responsible for the delay. Anyway, that's how things at the moment on the diplomatic and political front look to me. Now, there has been quite a lot of news on the military front. The Russians continued their various missile and drone strikes across Ukraine. We haven't yet had another big strike with Oreshniks or anything like that. The last one took place a few days ago. But every night, drones, Russian drones are active and Russian missiles are. And I've noticed a steady increase in the number of strikes using the Tsarkon hypersonic cruise missile. And I remain of the view that this very, very long range missile is before long going to supplement, though I doubt that it will ever completely replace, the subsonic cruise missiles like the KH-101 and the Kalibr in the Russian military arsenals. Anyway, for the record, most of the strikes again seem to be centred on attacks on Ukraine's energy system. I get the sense that the Russians are working towards dismantling or at least reducing this energy system, the electricity and heating systems. And as I've said already, I think this is all work that is preparatory to the big Russian offensive in the spring, probably in April, which is coming. But there continue to be movements on the front lines. And again, I think that there is a tendency to understate their significance in the West, or indeed to discuss them at all. Because bear in mind, discussing Russian military movements on the front lines would require an admission that places like Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Guliapolye, Toretsk, Chasiv Yar, all of these places, which according to the Ukrainians are still contested, are actually under Russian control. So for that reason, in the West, there's a desire to avoid discussing these particular advances. But nonetheless, they are taking place, and I will do a brief overview. Now, the Russians are claiming, or at least not the Russian Defense Ministry itself, but other Russian commentators are claiming that the Russians have successfully captured some positions to the west of Ternovata. Apparently there's another village, I believe it is called Zelichnia or something like that, immediately to the east of Ternovata. Supposedly this place has now fallen to the Russians. Well, I'm not able to provide full details, obviously, but that's what the claims say. And the interesting thing for me about that is that if these reports are true, and by the way, for the record, I believe they are, then it means that the Russians are pressing westwards from Ternovata. And that can only mean that they continue to control Ternovata. And if they do control Ternovata and are able to advance westwards from Ternovata, then that must mean that if there is indeed a Ukrainian Zaporozhye counteroffensive taking place northeast of Ternovata, then that offensive must have stalled, because I cannot imagine that the Russians would be continuing to advance westwards from Ternovata, and by the way, from Guliapolye as well, if the Ukrainians were advancing northeast of the Russian positions in ways that might cause the Russians, as they advance west, to be cut off from their supply lines. This whole narrative about a successful or ongoing Ukrainian Zaporozhye counter-offensive simply cannot be true if the Russian claims of advances are true. I suspect that over the next couple of hours, we will start to see video evidence from the Russians confirming that they are indeed advancing westwards, in which, as I said already, we can forget the whole narrative about a Ukrainian offensive northeast of Zaporozhye, northeast of Ternovata. Now, of course, if this is true, by the way, and if the Russians are breaking through and are starting to capture this chain of villages that exists on the west of the Gaichur River, then, as I've discussed in a recent programme, that brings the Russians within striking distance of the main supply road to Orekhov from the north. Some are saying that if all of these villages fall, it is basically the collapse of Ukrainian defences in Zaporozhye region, east of the city of Zaporozhye itself. That might be a bit overdramatic, especially as I firmly expect Zelensky to try to hold on to Orekhov as long as he can. But anyway, the Russians, for the record, do seem to be pressing westwards. And it does look as if, for the Ukrainians, the situation in Zaporozhye continues to deteriorate. Now, the Russians, according to Radovka yesterday, the Russians have now mostly surrounded the Ukrainian garrison, the Ukrainian forces, north of Pokrovsk, in the town of Belitska. And of course, we've had further reports that the Russians have mostly cleared Grishino. And there's been more claims. In fact, I don't think these are claims. I think that they are undoubtedly confirmation that the Russians have made further significant advances in Konstantinovka itself. Our old friend Andrei Marochko says that the Ukrainians are trying to rush reinforcements to Konstantinovka in order to try to hold back Russian advances, which in itself points to a potential operational crisis. Just saying. Anyway, that is Konstantinovka. Perhaps the most dramatic events, however, on the front lines continue to take place east of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. The Russian advance westwards from Siversk towards these two cities, these two key cities, is remorseless. It reminds me increasingly of the Russian advance in Zaporozhye region at the end of last year. It looks as if Ukrainian resistance in this area is very, very weak. It's only a matter of time, it seems to me, before the Russians reach the key positions of Rai Alexandrovka, which is the village to the east of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and before the Russians also capture the big power station to the east of Slavyansk itself. When the Russians capture these places, then it seems to me that we are in a situation where it becomes proper to say that the battle for Slavyansk and Kramatorsk will have begun, and that will be just weeks away. And the Russians continue to tighten their grip on Lyman. Apparently, several pockets of Ukrainian resistance close to Lyman have been extinguished. Lyman itself, I understand, mostly encircled. The Ukrainians still trying to resist there. I wonder for how long. And the same is true for the Ukrainians east of the Oskol River, in the Kupiansk area. Their forces there mostly extinguished as well now. There is, I think, one settlement left for the Russians to capture on the east bank of the Oskol River. And then the whole Kupiansk operation is over. And last but not least, there are many claims now that the Russians have resumed the Sumy offensive, that they've recaptured all of the positions that the Ukrainians captured during their offensive or counterattack in Sumy region in the summer, that all of those have fallen back under Russian control as the Ukrainians have transferred their forces to Donbass and Zaporozhye to try to hold their positions there. And the Russian commander in this area said some weeks ago that his forces are just 20 kilometers from the city of Sumy itself. And the latest advances seem to bring the Russians much closer. If the Russians were to find themselves in a position where they might potentially threaten the city of Sumy, well, I predict that in that case, that would create massive alarm in Kiev. I think that in that case, we would see a panic in Kiev, the like of which we have never seen at any stage since the start of the special military operation in February 2022. And, well, I think the political effects in Kiev of such an event would be very interesting to watch. By the way, I said in a recent program that Zelensky's extraordinary statements, which, by the way, have continued. Zelensky has been on a round of giving interviews. He's giving one interview after another at the present time, all of them basically saying the same thing. Ukraine's not prepared to withdraw from Donbass or anywhere else. Ukraine is not losing the war. It is winning the war. Ukraine, all it needs is to have continued unlimited support from the West. And for that support to continue to come in unlimited quantity, all of that sort of thing. Zelensky says that he wants Donald Trump to visit Ukraine itself. He must be very disappointed, by the way, that there's been a meeting in Kiev of European officials, senior European officials and leaders to commemorate the start of the special military operation. But the Americans stayed away. The Europeans were there, but the Americans didn't come. There was no senior official from the Trump administration turning up. I get the sense that the Americans have, frankly, given up on Zelensky. The relationship between Zelensky and Trump has become very bad, has always been very bad, and I think it is, to all intents and purposes, all but broken down. Just saying. But anyway, Zelensky's on this round of interviews. I said that his statement to the cabinet that Ukraine should look forward to a further war of 3 years, further 3 years of war, went down incredibly badly with Zelensky's cabinet, and that I sense that a pre-coup situation might be developing in Kiev. And I was very interested to see that Gordon Hahn, a man for whom I have a huge respect, by the way, and who I think is one of the most insightful of commentators on this conflict, and somebody with whom I, by the way, I've also had my disagreements, as everyone knows. Anyway, I noticed with great interest that simultaneously with my video, literally simultaneously with my video, the two came out almost together, with my video about a pre-coup situation in Kiev, Gordon Hahn, who has his finger on the pulse in Kiev, of the situation in Kiev to a much greater extent than I do, that he came back. He's written a piece saying exactly the same thing. Anyway, there it is. We're 4 years on. There's again reports that Ukraine is facing a financial crisis in April. The 90 billion euro loan has not materialized. As I said, the Russians continue to advance. April is the month when I expect the Russian offensive to begin, just saying. And a whole conflation of factors, to my mind, clearly point to a further crisis in the spring and summer. I said already that I think that the events of the next few months are going to be very difficult to explain away in the West. If the Donbass is cleared this year and the city of Zaporozhye is captured, and if the Russians really do start to things in the north of Ukraine, in Sumy region, and perhaps even start an operation to capture the city of Sumy, then I think the whole narrative about a stalemate will finally crash. And anyway, we will see at that point where we are. Now, I will just finish this programme by discussing very briefly the situation in Britain. There is a very, very complex, for the Labour Party, for Keir Starmer, a very difficult by-election on Thursday. Everybody expects Labour to lose. This is the by-election in the seat where Andy Burnham, Starmer's rival, wanted to run. Starmer blocked him. The Labour Party, its vote apparently has collapsed. At least that's what the opinion polls are saying, or at least the people on the ground are saying. We shall see. I would be surprised, if I can say it, if it were otherwise. There is no consensus, though, whether it be either the Greens or Reform that will take the seat, though at the moment the assumption is that it will more likely be the Greens. It is, after all, a seat which has traditionally voted for the Labour Party, which is a party of the left. But perhaps the other big blow for Keir Starmer is that his former ally, Peter Mandelson, has now been arrested over following the investigation involving Mandelson's leaking of private information from the British government to Jeffrey Epstein. Now, in several programmes, I pointed to the strange discrepancy, the fact that Andrew was arrested for doing that very same thing, and that Mandelson, against whom the case seemed to me to be far stronger, had not been charged, had not been arrested, sorry. Lots of people started to ask why Mandelson seemed to be treated more leniently than Andrew. I suspect the pressure grew, and of course, Mandelson has now indeed been arrested. Well, we will see what now happens, but I don't think this can possibly be good news for Starmer. If Labour loses the by-election on Thursday, then with Mandelson's arrest, I feel that Stalin was already basically untenable position is going to become more untenable still. He has not yet appointed a chief of staff to replace Morgan McSweeney, not that I know of. His team looks weak. At the moment, the reality is that Britain is not being governed at all because the Prime Minister has no authority and Britain has no effective government. It has an administration only, but not a government. And I can't imagine that this situation can continue for many more weeks. But there it is. It's a topic which we will discuss in a specific programme on the Duran. But this is where I'm going to end today's programme. To remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. Remember, you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.